So switching sides is a story about people that were practicing magic. Last night, we were talking about it a little bit with a witch who had called in when we were having open lines on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, if you're ever interested, Coast Insider gives you the ability to go back and listen to any show at any time, inexpensive, and you can find out more at coasttocoastam.com, where you can also get more details too on upcoming George Norrie appearances and paranormal date. Should always mention those. But what was really interesting about when she called was she was very matter of fact about the fact that she was a witch, and I was very matter of the fact that I was talking to a woman who was a witch, even though I am Christian. At a different time, though, that might have gotten both of us in a lot of trouble. She perhaps in at a different place, and not that many hundreds of years ago, might have been executed for even expressing an opinion like that, or at least so that's what we think. And or I could have been accused of being a witch just merely because I was being sympathetic and nice to her, and was not taking any position against what she was telling me about her life. Those were touchy subjects. Not just touchy, they made people really twitchy. And it's in understanding what really happened in Salem, that you may find yourself switching sides on where you are on the Salem witch trials. We'll tell you more about that next with our guest Tony Fells on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I don't know much about Tony Fells other than what it says in his bio, that he's an associate professor of history at University of San Francisco. Is that up to date, Tony?
No, not quite. I'm actually a professor emeritus of history, and I've just retired, actually, in the last couple weeks.
I'm looking at your photo right now. You don't look old enough to retire.
Ah, thank you very much. I actually taught there for 30 years and a couple years at other schools before that.
Wow, very cool. So I want to explain a little bit about the book. I would encourage people to buy it, but I want them to understand a little bit about what they're getting into, because your book, Switching Sides, How a Generation of Historians Lost Sympathy for the Victims of the Salem Witch Hunt, is a comparative analysis of the most famous books that were written about the Salem witch trials from perspectives that span about, what, about 70 years worth of books?
That's right, from World War II to the present.
Right. So it is in what academics might refer to as, I don't know what you would call it this, but to me it strikes me as a little bit of like an extended literature review. Of all of that has been written, and then you do an analysis kind of what their main thrusts were, what the weaknesses and strengths were of these works by previous historians. About right?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's a history of interpretations of the Salem witch hunt. Historians have a funny little technical term for it. We call it historiography,
right,
which is like the history of histories.
Right, like the biography of a history, if you look at it as history were a thing. Right. So that's what, I mean, and so it's really interesting, but it may be challenging for some people who are looking for something in a more narrative form, but you get to it. I mean, it's there in the book. And so I'm gonna have you unpack this for me in a slightly different way than you do in your book. So I'm gonna take you out of chronology a little bit.
Sure.
And let me just ask you up front, so that we're talking about, everybody knows what we're talking about. How was a witch defined in the 16th century? What did somebody mean when they said that there's a witch?
Well, a witch simply meant a person who was thought to practice through supernatural means a way to inflict harm on others. So someone thought to hurt someone else by means of supernatural forces was called a witch.
Was it only inflict harm, or was it could also have been to bring benefit to somebody?
Well, at that time period, witch only had a negative meaning. So a broader term that was used at the time is magic. And I think magic's the term that is broader that you're thinking of here, where it could be to do actually almost exclusively good things, things like healing, helping someone to heal, divining the future, otherwise known as fortune telling, trying to predict what would happen in the future, helping someone to find lost objects, inducing someone to fall in love with you, helping in some kind of project, or helping that your ship would sail without any mishap, and also warding off spells thought to be cast by a witch.
So
all those purposes are all clearly for good. Their use of the supernatural, of supernatural means in order to produce results of all sorts, but basically all good ones.
And that is what fell under the broader category of practitioners of magic.
That's right.
And witches were thought to be only those people that did the negative things, that is to say, cursings, not blessings.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Exactly. And some of the common charges that were brought against witches are worth noting. One of the biggest was causing babies or children to die, to get sick and die. Or your loved ones, a husband or wife who died, might have been thought to have been cursed by a witch, or actually witched to death was a phrase that was used at the time.
To witch as a verb.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
you were witched,
yes,
as opposed
yes.
to bewitched.
That's right. Lesser things like causing cows to stop giving milk. And
I was going to say crop failure, that kind of thing with diseases or the whatever. I'm still going to hold you back from all the different places you could go, but we'll get to them, I promise. But one of those is, I think, a very interesting concept that we have to address up front, is that witchcraft or magic or witchcraft, however we look at it, in this context, how did it fit into traditional Calvinist Protestant theology? You know, the Reformed theology that was dividing England between the Church of England and the traditional sort of Anglican Church, and then these Puritans within the church that were following a much stricter understanding of Christianity. How did they even factor in magic or the occult in their belief system?
Well, rather simply, they didn't. It was just considered forbidden. And the Puritans, since they were the stricter of the two Protestant camps between the Church of England or Anglicans on the one side and then the Puritans on the other, since the Puritans were stricter, they were just even more set dead against any form of magic. But so was the Church of England, and so was the Catholic Church, from which all of the Protestants had first come. So Christianity was really at war with magic practices from its early days.
All right, but this is a point I want to make that I think is really key. When somebody were talking about, oh, it's a witch hunt today, one of the presumptions is that from our own, you know, sort of postmodernist perception of how the world works, we would say, well, there's no such thing as witches. And so it is presumed in a witch hunt that you're going after something that does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I think, and I attended a Master's of Divinity from a seminary, which was technically Calvinist. Nobody takes seriously at anymore this notion of the power of witches. And so at the time, I think, I'm just trying to understand this, that they were told you shouldn't do it, but they actually believed that it did have power and that you could practice it. It's just you shouldn't practice it, not what are you doing? It doesn't even exist. It's not even real.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think what's hard for us to realize today in some circles, secular circles, but less hard for, you know, many religious people, is that it was completely plausible to imagine somebody using supernatural means to inflict harm on someone else. Because all you really need to believe in is a world of spirits. And, you know, to this day, a lot of people believe, a lot of
sure.
Christians in America believe
yeah.
in spirits. They're often called angels. And in earlier times, it was thought that there were both angels and demons because the devil himself was a fallen angel.
But a lot of people still believe in demons. There's a lot of people that
still believe in demons. So if you believe in a world of spirits and demons in particular, it's not a big leap to think that there could be a person or group of people who develop a practice where they can call upon these demons to hurt somebody else.
Right.
So it is very plausible, and I think that's the only reason why it existed. These people were not crazy. And so they absolutely had this belief of, it was nearly universal belief. There were very few people that wouldn't have believed that witchcraft was possible in the 17th century.
And so was magic, which is interesting because in a way, you know what it kind of follows is a little bit of the storyline of the TV show Bewitched. Because remember, this is, I don't know why it struck me this way when I was reading the book, but remember Samantha in Bewitched was trying not to use her magic. And she was trying to live a normal mortal life. And that's what her husband was trying to get her to do too, while her mother was saying, you're denying your heritage, you're denying your talents, you're denying your ability. And so it was sort of presumed that she could do it. She was just choosing not to do it. And I think that's where, when some people think about magic back then, it must have been very tempting. If you were trying to, if you were so in love with somebody and they were about to sail on a ship, that you might go see somebody who's in the occult to put a blessing on that ship through magic so that they would come back to you. You might feel guilty that you had stepped outside of your own faith tradition, but at the same time, you felt like you were doing anything you could to bring this person back to you alive, and that that was thought to be like something that was viable, something that actually wasn't a waste of money or time or whatever, that it really would work.
Yes, and I think it would have definitely been thought to have been viable, and actually you probably wouldn't have gotten into much trouble if you did what you just said, put a blessing on the ship. But what if that same ship were to, you know, hit a reef or be shipwrecked? Then the community, think of all the people they've lost, their husbands, whatever, their sailors, now they think of who's in this community that we've always suspected had the power to put a curse on the ship, not a blessing on the ship. And that's really how witch hunting gets going.
Yeah, so interesting. And of course, then there's this natural tendency in us humans to look for scapegoats when things go wrong that we can't explain. And we know this is true because the model for that is in the very same Bible that these Calvinists would have been reading, that there was a belief even of witches in a biblical sense that practiced numerology and practiced some other things which were on the fringe, but also in the belief that you could, you know, you could take all of the evil of a town and you could, you know, instill it into a goat, and you could run the goat through the town and put all of the bad things that were happening to the town and all the sins of the people onto the goat and force the goat into the woods, and that was your scapegoat. That was goat had left, had taken all that with you.
Yeah.
So even Christians believed even in that same type of magical thinking, because that was, at least the model for it existed in the Bible, that you could do things like that. It's just you weren't supposed to.
Yes. I completely agree. And in a way, you're really referring to the principle of a sacrifice.
Right.
And it's kind of perhaps a fine line between the parable of the escaped goat that you're referring to from the Bible to sacrifices that are often at the heart of many religions in a positive sense. That is, practitioners think of them positively. So you can see how easy it would be to, you know, cross that line and blame somebody in a community when mishaps happen, when misfortune happens. And there's no, and often, especially when there's no good explanation for it. I mean, today we do have a lot more explanations for a misfortune. We still don't have explanations for everything, but we have more than be owing to science than people did back then.
So when there was a plague, there had to be a fungus among us. We had to find somebody, right? And then that's, if you could eradicate that person or that community from your own community and get them outside of it, and then by coincidence, eventually the disease ran its course, then you could go, see, we were right. And then that would establish to other communities downriver that, oh yeah, that's the way to get rid of that. And so it's a way of it sort of established a model that in times of stress and crop failure and death and whatever, look for witches because they could be operating right under your very nose. And you won't be able to, you need to ferret them out if you're going to save the community.
That's very true. And one of the 20 people who was executed at Salem, and the Salem witch hunt was a woman named Martha Carrier, and she was accused of bringing smallpox to the neighboring town of Andover. And many of the people, both in her, many of the men, interestingly, in her own family died from it, as did others in the community. And that was definitely one of the factors in the accusations against her as a witch.
All right. So we're just scratching the surface, but I just felt like I wanted to establish up front, you know, what we're talking about when we talk about witchcraft, when we talk about magic, and when we talk about how communities were responding to stress and how it fit into theology, because there is a theological component. There's a dispute in the town of Salem, in the community of Salem, between two different, there's a push and a pull between two different factions of Puritanism, which we'll get to coming up, which also perhaps played into this. But you're already seeing in this conversation with Tony that, you know, there's a lot more about this story than most people know. It isn't just a matter of a bunch of writhing teenage girls who are looking for attention, which is more of what we kind of think about the story as anybody would have experienced it in watching The Crucible, the Arthur Miller play, is that it's much more, the nuances of who got accused and why goes much deeper than what we would have seen in that play. But I think that play is what a lot of people still go by in their understanding of what happened in Salem.
Yes, I think that's true. I think it has defined the popular understanding of Salem all the way to this day. It's just interesting that the academic understanding of Salem in the universities has moved away from that version.
And as you point out, become less sympathetic to the victims. Explain that before we go to the break.
Well, that's probably part of a longer discussion.
Yeah.
Basically, I do look at four of the most of the leading books that have come out about Salem by academic scholars, by academic historians from the late 60s to the present. And one way or another, they end up sympathizing with the accusers rather than the accused.
That's so fascinating.
I can say more about that.
Oh, yeah, you will, because we got a couple hours with you, so don't worry. But but along the way in the book, you really do explain how all of these pieces came together in a way. This was just the way the planets lined up. It could have not gone the way that it did. It could have been a witch scare, which was just like a minor footnote in history, but it went beyond that, and it turned into essentially an execution spree.
Yep,
in the town, we can never say that we don't have sympathy for the victims of being essentially murdered by their own community for something of which they've been accused falsely. But we should also add, and then this will take us up to the break and for next hour, but there were people who were saying, yes, I have done this. So they weren't entirely, I mean, there were some people who had used the word witch in a kind of self-description, or at very least were known for talking about magic.
In fact, over 40 people at Salem confessed, and that really added to the witch hunt, because once you have people confessing, well, that adds credibility to the charges.
Yeah, but confessed and confessed under duress, like under torture or under leverage?
But it mostly wasn't that. There are a few instances of torture, but it really was mostly not. I mean, duress for sure, but the whole community was under duress in a sense. But it was a lot was a sense of guilt. A lot of people were such strong believers that they looked into their conscience and they said, well, gee, maybe I really did let Satan in. Maybe I fell down in my faith.
Well, that's just where we'll start then when we come back. Tony Fels, a professor emeritus, a historian. The book is Switching Sides: How a Generation of Historians Lost Sympathy for the Victims of the Salem Witch Hunt. There be witches. We'll get more into that. The real witches next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. Well, this is a show I've been looking forward to for weeks and talking a lot about. Last night, we were talking about this, and I got a call from a witch, and I want to bring that into the conversation here, too, coming up. But most importantly, I want to just want you to open your mind a little bit, that everything you think you know about the Salem witch trials is wrong. We'll start there. next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Tony Fels, researcher, historian, switching sides. We're talking about the Salem witch trials. And I was reminded when I was talking last night during Open Lines with a witch that there are, and there's actually somebody who's tweeting me about this too on Twitter right now, at Deacon Punnett, my handle there, that, you know, the idea of the devil is not part of witchcraft, it's part of Christianity. It's been pushed onto witchcraft from Christianity, but as Wiccan people would tell you, that's not part of their theology. They're not devil worshipers. They worship a kind of, you know, earth magic, you know, the kind of thing which they, natural magic, as they would understand it. And I think that's also important to point out, too. During the, there was this line that there was this great fear that Satan was there among them in Salem, and the conduit to the community was through people that were dabbling in magic or witchcraft, not the upstanding righteous Christians of Salem. They were holding the wall against Satan, but these other people who were, you know, they were falling down in their faith, they were the ones that were opening the door for the devil to enter into the community and to create mayhem. Is that about right?
Yes, and even more than that, the religious people of Salem and of Massachusetts believe that these witches would actually go so far as to overthrow Christianity and establish a full opposite church in which Satan would be worshipped.
But this is interesting.
And I would say, I should add, nothing that I'm talking about is related to the religion of today called Wicca, which, as you were describing, based on your caller from yesterday, that's a religion that's kind of retaken the word witchcraft and turned it into something completely positive. And so that's very different. But in the 17th century, witchcraft had only this very negative, Satan-oriented meaning.
I'm going to pull on that thread a little bit, because I think, and like I said, I had to keep referencing this caller, but it was an interesting conversation. And she said, I asked her whether she ever said, I'm a witch, to people, to other people, for shock value. And she said, no, not really. I've been it for a long time. And I said, okay, how about when you were just first starting out? And she pretty much said, yeah, probably in the beginning, I would say that and get a knowing I was going to get a reaction. And I can't help but reflect on that as being also similar to what I believe was consistent in a few of the cases in Salem, with people who were standing outside of the propriety of the Salem leadership, and that they might have, you know, thrown about the practice of magic or talked about their dabbling in magic or witchcraft as almost kind of a thumb in the eye to the community.
Yes, I think that's certainly likely. And, you know, in a very offhand way, or sometimes someone might be embittered and throw out a curse and something like that. But what's significant is there's just no evidence that there was any organized practice of using supernatural means to harm other people. There's just no evidence of it at all. And so, even though it was thoroughly plausible, that's what's so interesting about it. It's completely plausible. But we have to remember that these Puritans were really, they had come to New England to found a utopian religious community, which they did, first in Plymouth and then Massachusetts and then Connecticut and Rhode Island and so forth. And they were very committed people. Now, granted, not absolutely every person in the community was like that, but they were the great preponderance, let's say 80% or 80-90%. So these are very serious-minded religious people, and so it's not likely that you would find too many of them, you know, really dabbling in something that genuinely was satanic.
But there might have been, knowing personality types and knowing that one thing about people really hasn't changed, there will always be somebody that might stand up against the majoritarian viewpoint. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really important to point out is that in Salem, as I understand it from your book, that Salem as a utopian experiment was really more socialist as we would understand it today, that it was about the commonwealth, and it was about, you know, it was doing good and sharing in the bounty of all of the community efforts. And yet there was a movement which we would actually probably identify as being sort of a distinctly American-like individualism, that there was a movement toward capitalism and about pulling away from being part of the collective. And that, too, was at work at the same time in Salem.
Yes, most of the Puritans would probably not have seen those two things in conflict because they were really committed to hard work. We really get the work ethic from this particular branch of Protestantism. And so they were very committed to hard work. They believed in, you know, making a little extra so that they could improve their properties, and they even believed in investment. And so early forms of capitalism and Puritanism, for the most part, were not at odds. Now, in some of the towns, like Boston and Salem Town, which was next door to Salem Village, you will find people who we might say were, you know, headed in a more secular direction, and they were probably starting to pursue profits without a great deal of attention to the good of the community. But that would be... that was only a very small number, and for the most part, the two really went together.
Okay, but, and I think this is where maybe the map that you call into question comes into it. Some of this tension might have been represented by how far away from the community itself were people living who were accused later of being witches. And this is a contended point amongst historians, that the geography or the ethnography, maybe, or the layout of this town may have played a part in who got accused and who was the accuser.
Well, that is the argument of one of the books that I talk about. It's the book called Salem Possessed by Paul Boyer and Stephen Nissenbaum. But a number of historians, and I'm only the last and the one who kind of summarized it all, have shown that this is really an exaggerated argument, and that the main reason why you have somewhat more of the accusers of the accused over on the side of the town rather than the interior part of the village has really much more to do with families and the kind of land ownership that extended families had. And so if somebody was thought to be a witch, and very often, you know, this idea was carried down through generations. So, for example, one of the most famous people killed, executed at Salem was Rebecca Nurse. Well, the Nurse family owned a great deal of property on the eastern side of Salem Village toward the town. But the main reason why Rebecca Nurse was accused had to do with the fact that her mother had been accused of witchcraft. And her grandmother, I believe, before that. So it was much more the belief that somebody carried the capacity for witchcraft, not so much by heredity, although that was possible, but it was mostly thought that it was handed down by training from one generation to the other. And it was typically through women, but not exclusively. And so that pattern that Paul Boyer and Stephen Nissenbaum thought they were detecting as something to do with the interior of the village versus the people who live closer to the town really doesn't hold up when you examine better reasons to explain that distribution.
And yet, you also touched on a very key point in there, that what does seem to be very consistent and does stand up to scrutiny is the disproportionate amount of persecution of women, and more specifically of independent women in the community.
Absolutely. And the numbers, the statistics are really telling. It's 80%. 80% of all the people accused of witchcraft throughout 100 years of New England, not just Salem, but in fact Salem was a slightly less percentage than the usual. But the usual percentage was 80%. 4 out of 5 people accused of witchcraft were female. And that percentage, by the way, is exactly the same in Western Europe during the era of witch hunting, of which the Salem witch hunt is just simply one part, where the New England was just a little outpost of Europe. And in all of the European witch hunting that went on from the late 1400s to the early 1700s, 80% of those accused were women.
Okay. So let's look at some other common characteristics. They were women. Were they mostly single women?
They were. The main person who's written a lot about this is Carol Carlson in her book, The Devil in the Shape of a Woman. And she finds that actually many were married, but their husbands were not around oftentimes. Like perhaps they had died, or they had shipped out, or they were just not present. And so, which meant that they had less protection from the men in their family. And also the fact that they may have been single, widows or something like that did make them somewhat suspect, because the role of a woman in the 17th century, including in Puritan New England, was to be what they called the helpmeet, the helper, the subordinate helper to her husband. And that was her main role, along with bearing children. So if you were independent, yes, you were more likely to be suspect.
Okay. So let's, again, we're looking for so common characteristics then for the people who were most likely to be accused of a witch were independent women that maybe were partnered, but could also have had the partnership dissolved in some form, or it was in a varying stage of decay of some sort. He could have been on a ship that hadn't come back for years, or maybe in a different town or whatever, and that the fact that they were not maybe they didn't fit the norm for what the majoritarian culture in Salem thought a woman, a proper woman, a proper Puritan woman would look like, and that this would put her almost immediately in the crosshairs during a witch hysteria.
Yes, that's absolutely right. They might, for example, have inherited property because, let's say, they didn't have a brother who would have taken over the land from their parents, or because a husband had died. So they may have had some economic independence. They may have been somewhat sexually unorthodox. One way or another, they did depart to some degree from these norms of what women were supposed to be like.
Okay. But the sexual unorthodoxy, so we don't know a lot about this because this wasn't necessarily something that everybody spoke about openly, but the insinuation is that in at least in some of these marriages, there might have been infidelity, and the infidelity might not have just been on the part of the husband, but also the wife.
I suppose that's true. I don't feel I know too much about that. That's not the main charge, however.
Okay, what's the main charge?
The main charge, according to Carlson's book, is that they had economic independence and also that they were outspoken. They spoke out almost following from another famous early Puritan, Anne Hutchinson, who is known as, she's kind of given the pejorative name, antinomian, but really she just was somebody who believed that she could communicate with the spirit world and God just as well as a ordained minister could. And she was not shy about letting members of her congregation know how much she had studied the Bible and spoke about it and even developed the following. Well, people like that who were outspoken or held property themselves or in one way or another were demonstrative people, They were mostly the ones who would who could be accused.
Like a woman who was involved in a lawsuit.
Exactly. Lawsuit is a good example of someone like Susanna Martin, who was one of the 20 executed at Salem. She had brought suit because she felt that she deserved a greater share of the inheritance than she got from her father. So that kind of thing.
Okay, but I was speaking about the sexual unorthodoxy. Mm-hmm. So I thought that there were some discussions about, you know, fidelity. But if not, what did you mean when you talked about sexual unorthodoxy?
Well, I think that sort of thing, but mostly it would have been sex before marriage. That would be, and that was not apparently so thoroughly uncommon among Puritans, but it could get you into trouble, especially if you were a suspect for any other reasons.
Okay. So the pattern builds, and then we put on top of that that there are, of those people who were accused, as you said, about 40% of them admitted, perhaps in their piety, in a self-reflection, in a confessional mood, of wanting to restore themselves to their faith, and wanting to be true to their baptismal vows, that they admitted, I have dabbled in magic and or witchcraft. And you said it was about 40%
actually,
of the people.
What I was saying was that over 40 of the 150 people who were accused at Salem confessed.
Okay. Thank you for that correction.
So it's still a big percentage. It's, close to a third of the people accused. So,
how many of the people that were executed? How many
of the people? Over 150, and historians do disagree about the exact number, but a common term statistic used is over 150.
Now, I thought only 20 got executed in Salem.
Correct. 20. I'm only speaking about the Salem witch hunt now, not all the lesser witch hunts throughout New England. So, yes, 150 were accused. Of those, a little over 40 confessed. 20 were executed, of which 14 were women, 6 were men. And then it's also interesting to add that 5 more of those 150 who were accused did die in jail. So it's true only 20 were executed, but really 25 people lost their lives owing to the Salem witch hunt.
Of the 20, how many had confessed seemingly of their own free will, not under torture of being a witch?
Oh, that's a key question that you just asked, and the answer is none. And that's what's so important about the Salem witch hunt. The only people who were executed were ones who denied their guilt to the very end, who said, this is not true. I have never practiced witchcraft. And whereas the 40 who confessed never were executed, and almost all were never even tried. Just a few started to be tried by the end of the 6 or 7 months of this whole wave of fear and terror that overtook the community. So this is a key point. In other words, if you stuck to the truth and declared that you were innocent, and you were liable to be executed, whereas if you confessed, which would, of course, include people that we've spoke about a moment ago who really did feel that they had in some way or another invited Satan in, they had failed to live up to the highest ideals of their faith, but would also include others who just kind of noticed this pattern, and they said, I better confess, and others, relatives, were pushing them to confess in order to save themselves. So the confessors were a mix of people who probably really believed that they had done something in leaning in the direction of witchcraft, and others who were just hoping that this would enable them to survive.
So this kind of parallels the whole plea bargain, you get a better sentence. If you go to trial, you risk execution.
Right.
I mean, it sort of follows to this day. Plead to a lesser charge and plead guilty to it, even if you didn't do it, because then you'll be perceived more sympathetically than if you insist that this isn't true and you're going to try and prove it just by putting your credibility against your accusers.
Right. And I think Puritans did. I mean, part of them, they were partly following the injunction in the Bible to never let a witch live. In other words, anyone who confessed to witchcraft should be killed, should be executed. But another part of the Puritans did believe in redemption, and they felt if someone really showed remorse for their failings, that maybe they should be, allowed to remain in the community.
All right. So that's going to bring us up to the top of the hour. Hang on, Tony. There's two things I want to get to right away. One is some of the ways in which it was presumed that an accused witch could prove that they weren't, some of the things that they were supposed to be able to say or do, which would have proved they weren't a witch, which may or may not have worked. And then, okay, with everything we've established so far, how could we ever be sympathetic to the accusers? We'll get to that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.